From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Linda Tirado's essay on the harsh realities of living in poverty tore up the internet last year. She meant it for family and friends. It ended up getting over 6 million views and prompted a lot of conversation. She's been lauded as a truth teller and derided as a fake poor person. And now she's got a new book that explores life the way millions of Americans live it, in and on the edges of poverty. This hour on Point, hand to mouth in America. You can join us on air or online. Are you living in poverty or on the edge? Do you feel like the national discussion has shut you out? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me this hour from St. Louis, Missouri is Linda Tirado, her online essay from last year, Why I Make Terrible Decisions or Poverty Thoughts, has been read by over 6 million people. Her new book is Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Linda Tirado, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
I'm so happy to be here, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, so the book is based on this impromptu response you wrote online one night after a particularly grueling shift at work. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I actually went online and I was talking to my friends and somebody basically said, why shouldn't I be angry when I see people doing things that I think are wasteful and I see them taking public money? And the essay wasn't actually an essay. It was an incredibly long response. And what I basically said was, you don't get to pick. You don't get to judge. You don't get to look at somebody in the grocery store line that one time for 5 minutes and assume that you understand their financial history or their situation. And even if you did, even if that person is desperately poor and is getting food stamps and has their entire life and has never worked a day, how do you have the right to tell another human being that they can't have one nice thing? Where do you get to make the judgment about the one nice thing another person has? And how can you look at yourself and say, I am qualified to make that judgment and more, I'm qualified to enforce it? That isn't really a thing that I think most people would like to have done to them. And my point was basically, so you don't get to do it to anybody else either.
So here you were. You thought you were just offering a response to an insensitive comment or question online. What was the response to your poverty thoughts?
Insane. To begin with, it was just a lot of people saying, oh, this is really good. I think I'll share it. You should share it. And then it was on the front page of the Huffington Post, and the world kind of exploded for a while there. The response was kind of came down in two parts. It was either people looking at it and saying, I recognize that, or people looking at it and saying, I don't recognize that, and therefore you are wrong. And it really kind of went into one of those two camps. Even when I heard from folks that would say, well, I understand why you would say that. I get the time and the energy and all of that, but I respond differently. I have a different way of doing things. And that's totally valid. But mostly it was an awful lot of people saying, well, this can't be true. Or this is absolutely true. And it really split down those two lines.
So you grew up largely middle class. You attended college, as I understand, worked as a political organizer. Tell us how you entered the ranks of the working poor.
Yeah. Well, I graduated from high school when I was 16, actually. Went away to junior college, promptly did about as well as you'd expect a 16-year-old on their own without their parents to do. And then I decided instead of taking out more money in student loans and doing poorly in school, I'd just take a couple of years, grow up a little bit, and then go back when I was ready for the commitment and the financial responsibility of school. And then the economy kind of exploded, and I never did make it back.
Your husband
and I found myself working, you know, increasingly worse jobs, just like everybody else.
And your husband was just home from Iraq, and you were pregnant with your first child. And as you write, it seemed you'd done everything right, but you couldn't quite make it.
Yeah, and really that's kind of what I talk about more broadly is, look, I made a few terrible decisions. That's why I called it that, why I make terrible decisions, because the point is a decision that retrospectively looks terrible might not be the worst decision at the time. It might be the best of two bad options. And if you're taking the best of two bad options, you can't expect it to be sunshine and flowers. I had a choice between continuing to take on massive amounts of debt and fail out of school school, which was clearly going to happen, or dropping out of school? Which is the better choice in that circumstance? Obviously, the rosiest scenario would have been that I would have been mature and ready enough for school when I went the first time. That would have been great, but that wasn't the situation I found myself in. When Tom came home from Iraq, again, we made kind of terrible decisions. If you look at it from the outside, he wasn't getting his GI Bill funding that we were supposed to get. So we got the worst apartment we could possibly find. Both of us got, you know, really, really, really low paid jobs while he put himself through school. And because we lived in the worst apartment we could find, when there was a summer storm, the drains backed up and it ruined everything we owned because the landlord didn't maintain the property correctly. And those are the things that catch you, where you're really trying to get out. You really, really are. And you can see your way forward, and then you have one crazy accident and off it goes, and you're back at the very, very bottom, and people are asking you, why didn't you do better? And why aren't you a little more hopeful? And it feels Sisyphean. And if you are Sisyphus pushing that stone up that mountain over and over and over again, it's incredibly enraging when somebody comes to you the thousandth time you've pushed that rock up the mountain and says, you know, if you just have a little more faith, maybe this time's going to be the one that gets it.
You write in the book, I'm going to read here, what I can say for sure is that downward mobility is like quicksand. Once it grabs you, it keeps constraining your options until it's got you completely. I slid to the bottom through a mix of my own decisions and some seriously bad luck. I think that's true of most people. While it can seem like upward mobility is blocked by a lead ceiling, the layer between lower middle class and poor is horrifyingly porous from above.
Right. Well, we know that people who are working class, and we call these people the working poor, we're talking service workers, folks in blue collar jobs, most of those people will have a spell of actual, like, marked poverty a few times in their life. That's half of America will be in these poverty circumstances at some point in their life. And yet we still like to think that you can only go down if you personally have done poorly, and you go up if you personally do well. And we never look at all of the systemic stuff that's kind of keeping mobility and stratification in the places they are. For every case like me, for everybody who's been plucked from obscurity and given a book deal, there are millions who are still doing all of the exact same things that I did this time last year. 45 million people are still in the exact same situation. And yet we look at me and say, oh, the American dream exists. My American dream is not that one out of millions will be, you know, taken and given all of this opportunity and all of these wonderful things that have happened to me. My American dream is that those 45 million people are going to go to work. They're going to do their jobs. They're going to be able to put food on the table for their families and more. They'll have the time to go home and eat it with them.
Would you describe, Linda Tirado, just one day of your life at your lowest point as you remember it, living in poverty?
The very, very worst. It was when we were in Cincinnati, actually. We were in that very worst apartment. We had moved there when we discovered we were pregnant with our first child, assuming that the GI Bill, you get a living stipend and your books and tuition paid. And we thought, okay, that's the most stable situation we can get into while we figure out, you know, our new lives with this baby on the way. And the living stipend never came because there was a paperwork screw up. So 4 or 5 months we'd go in every week. They'd say, oh, it'll be here next week. Oh, it'll be here next week. And both of us were working part-time at Burger King, just barely able to make rent. I'm getting progressively more pregnant. I couldn't find any health care. And then we got a call from the federal government saying, we accidentally overpaid you when you were in Iraq, and we failed to catch that error. And we're going to start garnishing your wages unless you give us $5,000. And it's the only time in my life I have ever seen my husband, who went to war with the Marines in Fallujah, get violent. He punched a wall. I was crying. It was really bad because it was just the one thing too many. It was the one thing too many. And it took us probably 6 hours to stop feeling as though the world had just ended. We couldn't think what to do. If they took what little we were making out of our paychecks, how were we going to pay the rent? And how do you bring a baby into that? And what do you mean they overpaid us? You won't give us our money that you owe us. What do you mean we owe you? It was partially bad because of the finances, but partially it was just the insult of it. It was the last insult we could tolerate.
You're careful to say, Linda, that your views are your own, that,
yes.
You know, not those of everyone living in poverty, but do you think overall your experience is representative of most working poor?
I am very careful to say I am not representative. I am indicative, which is to say we all have the same crap bosses. We all have the same crap jobs. We all have jobs that don't put their hours up until a week ahead of time. We all have the same strictures in our lives. How we respond to them is individual and unique. Some people go to church. Some people drink a lot. Some people chain smoke. Some people, you know, everybody's got their coping mechanisms. And everybody's got their own personal way to look at it. People often come to me and say, well, tell me why poor people vote against their own interests. And by that, they mean, why are they voting Republican? And the thing that I like to tell people is 45 million people are not all going to be in one political party, okay? There's a lot of conservative poor folks out there. There's a lot of working class conservatives. There is no way to put us in a box. We are a third of the country. We are individuals. And we have that dignity. And so I'm very, very careful to separate myself from somebody else, because what I do may be looked down on by another person. They might be looking at me and judging me really hard and saying, you shouldn't do that. I don't believe in that. And they'd be just as right as I am to look at them and judge them for their characteristics. I mean, all humans do that. But I am not every person I have ever known.
And so who do you hope reads this book then?
Anybody who goes into any big box store or fast food joint and thinks that the cashiers are just stupid and dumb and that's why they have those jobs, those people should read this book. Any cashier who's been stuck at a table while somebody asks them, well, what do you mean you don't know how to do this, or you haven't done it properly, or anything like that, those people should read this book. Anybody who thinks that things are okay in this country and that an increasing GDP means an increasing recovery for the majority of America should read this book.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about living the reality of poverty in America this hour, and you can join the conversation. Are you in the middle class, worried about slipping into poverty? Have you made it out of poverty? What's your story? My guest this hour, Linda Tirado, author of Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Linda, the book is organized in a really interesting way. Each chapter is a stereotype of how poor people are often judged, in your opinion. Give us some examples of those judgments, your chapter headings.
My favorite is, we do not have children for the sweet, sweet government cheese. And I think that's paraphrased because there are words we don't say on the radio. You know, I've got way bigger problems than a spinach salad can solve. One of my editors helped me come up with that. And it's really, that's it in a nutshell, is we're talking about, why do you have sex? Why do you sometimes, you know, drink alcohol? Why do you have clothes that aren't hair shirts? I mean, how dare you have anything that's even a little bit nice? Why are you unemployed all the time? Why are you so lazy? Why do you have such terrible attitudes? All of the things that I've heard all of my life, I just thought, well, okay, well, I'll explain that then. I mean, I was checking Twitter on the break, and right now I've got a guy on Twitter who's listening to us. Hi, Harry. Who says, well, you know, if people choose to not work and be lazy, why should I pay for them? And I say, look, if you've got two jobs and 100 job applicants, you cannot call 98 people lazy. I don't care if it is the idea that you have about all poor people. I don't care if it does make you feel better to think that all you have to do is go down to the good job store and buy yourself a good job, and you'll have one of those, and it's just a matter of not wanting to walk down and get one. That isn't the way the country works. We are not uniquely lazy. We are not uniquely full of vice. Look, we know that wealthy people have the same vices as the poor do. We know the STD rates track across classes. We know drug abuse rates track across classes. We know alcoholism rates track across classes. And so the point here, we do all of the same things. It's just that if you're wealthy, you do it out of nicer glasses and you're drinking better wine. And if you make a mistake, if you are 16 when you graduate from high school and you go to college and you find that you're not ready for it, you can just afford to take a couple of years off and then go back and pick up your life. Your mistakes have a cushion that they don't if you're working class. We're talking about folks that do not have $200 or $300 in their bank account. What happens if they have an emergency? And are they lazy simply because they didn't have that cushion? I would argue no.
Let me throw in some sound here, Linda. This is Senator Ted Cruz speaking at a 2012 Republican National Convention, this one in Tampa, speaking out against government programs that he said created dependency among the poor.
You are not doing anyone a favor by creating dependency, destroying individual responsibility. 55 years ago, when my dad was a penniless teenager, thank God some well-meaning bureaucrat didn't put his arm around him and say, let me take care of you. Let me give you a government check and make you dependent on government.
Linda Tirado, do you understand any piece of that or agree with any piece of that?
I do. I actually agree with a good portion of it. And what I would say is thank God 55 years ago when my father was penniless and entering the workforce, some well-meaning bureaucrat made sure there were jobs available for him to get so that he did not have to be dependent. I would say to Mr. Cruz, with much love and respect, that you, sir, have no idea what you're talking about. Nobody in America sits down when they're 7 years old and says, you know what I'm going to do when I grow up? I'm going to work two essentially meaningless part-time jobs and collect food stamps. That's not what anybody says or what anybody wants. Nobody goes to the food bank wanting to be there. You know what we want is an actual society that runs. It's a society that values a hard day's work. You remember 55 years ago in the golden age that we hear these people talk about, then you would hear things like, oh, you have a job. Well, you've done the thing then. You've done the thing because, you know, it does not matter how many people you educate and turn into working in creative classes or CEOs or doctors or lawyers. Somebody's always going to have to scrub the floors around here. We are always going to need engineers. We are always going to need cashiers and people to make our food and clean up after us. The question isn't how to make them stop doing those jobs. It's how to make those jobs not so bad that you're still having to collect food stamps. There is no reason that multinational corporations are handing out applications for welfare benefits with their new hire packets. When we are operating in that world, then Mr. Cruz's analysis is broken. He is analyzing a system that does not exist. That system does not exist. The system that exists is one that says you will be dependent because we choose not to create the work. And if you choose not to create the work, you cannot blame people for not working.
I want to get some calls in here with you, Linda. Sherry is in Portsmouth, Virginia. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I 3 years ago dealt with a house fire that destroyed all of my belongings. Everything burned to the ground. And I've spent the last 3 years trying to climb out of that foxhole and have found that dealing with people's attitudes toward me when I was had resources versus when I don't have resources is radically different. Your humanity is completely erased when you're poor because people have made these assumptions and have these stereotypes about who you are and how you got into this position. And being poor is a full-time job because there's so many obstacles that are placed in the way of just trying to maintain basic necessities in your life that you spend all of your time trying to just survive as opposed to trying to thrive. You're unable to do that when you've got to figure out how to get across town without a vehicle, and it takes 5 hours to travel 20 miles. And so, therefore, the idea of getting to the job interview or being to a job on time on a daily basis is almost impossible in the circumstances. So rather than being called lazy, it should be more working overtime in terms of what you do to survive. Mm. And so I really applaud the author for doing this work and helping to shine a real clear light on the humanity of the people who are suffering and dealing with these issues, because they are. One of the things I have discovered in terms of all the signs that society gives you, when you go into a restaurant and you see the sign that says, bathroom for customers only, that's telling the poor people, you're not welcome here. And that's happened. There are messages like that all over society in terms of when you're poor and struggling.
Sherry, thank you. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Linda Tirado, Sherry mentioned poverty being a full-time job. You write about how poverty is actually quite expensive as well.
Yes. And I mean, to begin with, look, you can't call somebody who's working two or three jobs lazy. I don't care what their jobs are. But yeah, poverty, being poor is a full-time job because and it is more expensive because instead of buying in bulk, the example I give is toilet paper. You can go to Costco and buy a huge thing of toilet paper for like $50 and it's going to run you, 50 cents a roll. if you don't have $50 upfront capital, you're going to go down to 7-Eleven. You're going to buy a single roll for $1.29 at your corner store. Now, in the aggregate, you are spending over twice as much for things. Look at things like payday loans or furniture rental, where to get these things that you need, because people do need access to credit from time to time, we're paying two or three times the APR. Now, that's based on our credit rating. Why do we have crappy credit? Well, a lot of times it's stuff like medical bills or school loans, things that we cannot refinance or declare bankruptcy on. So we're just stuck with that kind of credit rating our entire lives. Because of that, we wind up paying more for all of our goods and services, which actually keeps us poor. I have had the opposite of the experience that Sherry was just talking about, where she was doing okay and then she had an accident and she was fairly low, and she talked about the difference in respect. What's been shocking me since I've been doing the book and I've been kind of moving in all of these new circles is how much free stuff you get when you don't need free stuff. It's amazing. Free upgrades, stuff all over the place just to make your life a little more convenient. And what people do not realize is how much convenience costs. You can buy a new car with a warranty and it'll never have mechanical errors. It'll get you everywhere you need to go. If you're very poor, you're taking the bus. That 20-minute drive is going to take you 3.5 hours on the bus. All right. And then you've still got to come back.
Right. Let's go to Brantley in Mooresville, North Carolina. Hi, Brantley. I'm glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to comment and say, I don't come from money. I'm looking for a second job right now because I'm struggling. I'm in debt, and I have no problem with the taxes that come out of my paychecks going to welfare and supporting people. But I do have a problem because I know that, a lot of people are just struggling, and they just need that extra little help, and I have no problem with those people. But then on the other side, there are the other extremes where people do just want the free handouts. An example is my own sister, who I'm trying to change. But right now, she has no job. She's up in Washington State because marijuana is legal, and she has no job, and she is trying to have children so that she can get more money. She openly admits that. Those are the type of people I have problems with, because it does come out of my paycheck, and it doesn't go towards the people who need it. It is going towards selfish people who are trying to take from the people who do need the actual help. And then the other thing is that you say, the problem is it's really hard to find jobs. I completely agree. I'm having that struggle myself right now. So rather than having a financial system where it doles out assistance to people doles out money to people who need and don't need assistance, why doesn't it go into a system of the government that creates government jobs so that taxes come out rather than just to be handed out? People can get that extra job, get the work, and they earn the money that is coming out of the paycheck of with my taxes.
Brantley, thank you. Thank you very much for calling. Linda Tirado, there's Brantley saying, my sister has problems. And I guess the question is, what's the role of personal responsibility, personal choice when it comes to poverty?
And here, there are two things you have to keep in mind when we're talking about this. Okay, first, there are plenty of people who are not capable of working. Look, disability is a thing, and mental disability is also a thing. So when you're making those judgments from outside, again, you can look at somebody who looks like they're perfectly capable, and they're not for whatever reason. You can't make that decision. But secondly, look, there's always going to be a couple of people who game any system we put up. Let's go ahead and put that one out there. What I want to know is, why are we so worried about, minuscule percentage it is, because he talked about his one example, but then he also talked about himself, right? And being in a position where you're looking for that work and you're still not making it. So you got a 50-50 there. When you're looking at that, the question that I always ask is, why are you looking at somebody who's trying to collect a couple of $100 a month in food stamps in an economy, in a system where jobs are hard to come by, assistance is hard to come by? Why would you be looking at them and uniquely pointing that out when we know on the other side there are people who are scamming the system much more effectively, to the tune of millions, if not billions of dollars? Why are you looking at the woman on food stamps? Why look at the person who looks at the system and says, look, work is incredibly hard to come by. I can't do it. I don't think I've got what it takes. I think I'm going to wait this out and just try to eat in the meantime. And if something comes along, I'll take it. Because when I see people who have chosen not to work in those circumstances, almost all of the time, and I'm not even going to say I don't know a couple of people like that, but almost all the time they had been looking and they had been working for so many years that they just gave up. And giving up is different than never trying to begin with.
Right. Here's David in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you very much to your author guest today. I haven't read your book, but I went to graduate school in New Haven, Connecticut, and lived in a disreputable neighborhood. We had drug dealers across the street, prostitutes. I witnessed numerous evictions. We had gun violence. I actually saw a machine gun murder. I grew up in a middle-class academic family and was never exposed to anything but the middle class or the upper class. But I'm very grateful that I lived in that situation for 11 years because it gave me just a little bit of insight into just how difficult it is for so many people to live in such reduced circumstances into which none of them would willingly have chosen to have been born. We lost our car, so I took the bus for 3 years. When the guy next to you is drunk and vomits on you, it's a health concern. When you are out in the cold and you haven't done laundry for 3 weeks, but you have to walk your laundry through the snow a mile and a half in the brutal cold just to have clean clothing, that's a health issue. And beyond the health issues, there's just so many innumerable indignities that you are subject to. And my wife and I lived in poverty for 4 of those 11 years. We live in an affluent, middle-class, or upper-class town now, and are very grateful. And I don't presume to understand what it is. I mean, we have college degrees. We've traveled in different countries. We have so many benefits and opportunities that we're so fortunate to have had that people in many circumstances do not have.
Do not.
I don't presume that, but I would just urge anybody who says these people are lazy. I mean, how lazy is it to have 3 or 4 jobs and be trying to raise a child?
David, thank you. Thank you very much. Linda Tirado, would you respond?
Yeah, I can't say better than that. Walking your laundry through the snow is pretty much what it is to be poor. I will say, look, there I could go for hours. I literally wrote an entire book about all of the little roadblocks and all of the tiny indignities and all of the things that come together there that make it so intolerable. And it's why we see other societies doing things like setting up minimum incomes for their citizens. We see things like the NHS where you can – and I swear to God, this is true. I saw it. You can just go to a doctor. You just go there and they give you drugs that make you feel better and then you go home again and it costs you like $10. It's amazing. When we talk about social stratification, we talk about welfare and we talk about what it is to be poor, what we are actually saying is that we as Americans do not believe that there should be a single standard of living in America. We don't necessarily believe that life will be this good and no worse in America. We are saying we believe life should be as bad as it absolutely has to be unless you are uniquely talented, unless you are uniquely skilled. Because the other thing people never take into account, not everybody has huge amounts of ambition and talent and skill and intelligence, right? All of these folks that have made it to the top of their games that are doing really well and they look down on the rest of us and say, why haven't you done that? They are failing the very basic test of gratitude to be grateful for their brains that are above average. Because people look around and think, I am basically average. And everybody I know is basically average because they're everybody I know. And they've never stopped to think about what it would be like to be stuck at the bottom and know that you have to have 20 times the ambition and skill of a guy that got born, you know, $50,000 above you. And to look that down and to say, I'm going to keep plugging away at it for 20 or 50 years if that's what it takes. They've never thought about that.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about life in poverty in America, and you can join the conversation. Do poor and rich people live in separate worlds in this country? We're joined this hour by Linda Tirado, author of Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Melissa Boteach joins us from Washington. She's vice president of the Poverty and Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, author of a big report released just last week on the state of poverty in America. Melissa, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Tell us currently what the poverty rate is in this country.
Currently, there's 14.5% of Americans living in poverty. But as Linda mentioned, that's not the gauge of how many people are struggling to make ends meet. It's really closer to one in three Americans that are one missed paycheck, one broken bone, one sick kid away from poverty.
And how does the government define poverty per se?
Well, for a family of three, it's around $18,000 a year for, for example, a mother with two children. And you can see that even if you take into account the help that that parent may get, that is not enough to afford rent, to put food on the table, and to access all the things you need in order to advance in this country.
When people hear the poverty rate, we tend to think it's the same, 14.5, 15% of Americans, when in reality, people are cycling in and out, right? Explain that.
Exactly. That's a really important point, is that this is not some static group of people that just can't get themselves out of poverty. In reality, during the recession, for example, one in three Americans spent at least 2 months in poverty during that time. And recent research that came out last year showed that during their working years, four in five Americans will experience poverty, near poverty, or otherwise turn to the safety net. So if we imagined poverty not as this static state, but as something that happens because, our economy or because things happen to people, we would imagine our safety net more as social insurance rather than something that those other people need to use.
U.S. unemployment has fallen steadily in the past year from 7.2% a year ago to 5.8% in October. But in those numbers, the devil's in the details. So many people can only find part-time positions. In fact, the number of people working part-time involuntarily is more than 50% higher than when the recession began. These are people who want something more, but just can't find it, Melissa.
Exactly. You have millions of people who want full-time jobs and are still looking for them, but can only find part-time work. And the other piece that the unemployment story doesn't tell is the story of flat and declining wages, that even if you take into account that the unemployment rate is declining, there are still too many people whose incomes are significantly lower in real terms than they were before the Great Recession. But that hasn't stopped the rising of costs like healthcare and housing and education. And so you're really feeling this squeeze among the lower working and middle classes, that wages are stagnant or declining, costs are rising, and people are facing impossible choices.
What are the demographics of the poor in America? Does poverty cut across all lines or focus on just a few areas?
There is no area, there's no region in this country that doesn't have poverty. There's no race or ethnicity that does not experience poverty. However, that doesn't mean that some people aren't disproportionately feeling it. So, for example, even though whites are plurality of those in poverty, communities of color, Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans in particular, have much higher rates of poverty. Women have higher rates of poverty than men, and children have among the highest rates of poverty of any age group. And single mothers in particular are really struggling to make ends meet.
Let's go back to the calls here. We have so many. Deep River, Connecticut is where Jill is. Jill, welcome to On Point. I'm so glad you called.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just had a couple thoughts, and I wanted to get your guest's thoughts on them. So my situation is my husband and I are in our early 30s. We both started small businesses and basically doing everything we can to be financially responsible, to save, to start a 401k for retirement, and we're having to defer starting our family just because we don't think it's the financially responsible thing to do at this particular moment. But, as we all know, you have a limited amount of time in which to start a family. And listening to the author's story, talking about her and her husband, expecting their first child, I couldn't help but think, well, it was that the responsible choice, which of course led me to some, I consider myself socially liberal, very supportive of social services, and so was a bit horrified at myself for thinking that, and just wanted to know your guest's thoughts on whether or not starting a family is is now a privilege of class in the United States. So thank you, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Jill, thank you. Linda Tirado.
Yeah, that was one of the nicest ways to frame that question I've ever heard, so thank you for that. But what that question really comes down to is, weren't you too poor to have a child in that situation, and how did you justify that? And so from my personal situation, we actually both were employed when we got pregnant. The poverty happened when the government failed to come through on the promised GI Bill stipend, and that wasn't until well into the pregnancy when abortion wasn't an option. But even if it hadn't been, even if I had been desperately poor, there is a level at which you cannot stop people from having families. There is no moral way to justify it. And it's tricky when you're saying, but you can't barely take care of yourself. How are you going to feed this child? I will tell you this. It takes $280,000 in America to raise a child from birth to college in a middle-class way right now. And I will start answering the questions of how can you justify having that child the second we start asking everybody to come up with proof positive that they have $280,000 in their bank account upon conception, so that we can make sure that there won't be any accidents or anything in those people's future that might land them in a bad situation. Because that's the slippery slope you're running into, is when you say, are you rich enough to have a child? What you're saying is, how rich do you need to be? And I will need that line demarcated for me before I will accept that there is a level below which you should not have children, because children need love and they need comfort and they need family. And you cannot simultaneously say, have dreams, have hope for the future. This country is a fantastic place to be and you can do amazing things, but also don't have any children, because you have to have a bleak, loveless future with no family and no comfort and nothing like that, despite millennia of people always having children. It's an uncomfortable question. There's no good way to ask it, and there's no good way to answer it, because the question itself, I think, is kind of invalid.
Hakash is calling from Austin, Texas. Hakash, thank you for calling. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't think laziness is the right term, but sometimes an unwillingness to try something new stops people. While the Occupy Wall Street protests were going on, I know some of those people just wanted jobs. And at the same time, there was a gas boom happening in North Dakota, and they were desperate for people to move there. And I was wondering, why don't these people just go to North Dakota and find a good-paying job?
Sure.
Hakash, thank you. Linda.
Well, for a bunch of reasons, actually. A, do you know how expensive it is to move across states? B, do they have any support network there once they get there? Because what if the jobs don't actually exist? Or what if they're not suited for the work? Or what if they get there and they get hurt in a week and they've got nothing to do? Three, how many jobs are up there exactly? Four, are they physically capable of doing incredibly rough manual labor in an environment that's mostly full of men and sexual assaults, as we've had reported? Fifth, which jobs are they, and how many people are already going there? And by the time you get there, are all the jobs going to be taken? Six, where are you going to live? Do you have any idea of the geography? Maybe you don't own a car. Do you know how to survive in that space?
And
I could keep going.
And they're all excellent points, but I think what he's saying is try something new. He's saying get out there and push yourself, because if you don't, you're stuck
sure.
in this
and
particular position.
And on the other
position.
Hand, we're also going to hear, don't take risks that you can't afford to cover. Right. So essentially what he's saying is, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And also, you know, don't beat your head against the same wall. Find a new wall to beat your head against. And that's all well and good. But how many walls do I need to find?
And
at what point is it too risky? I could have started a couple of new businesses, but I didn't know that I would be able to get that worked out. It could put me in a worse situation. And then I would have to deal with the ramifications of that. Sometimes the devil you know is better.
And I just want to add in one point,
which is,
we've been focused a lot on the choices that individuals make, which I think is important. But I think we also need to sort of lift things up a bit and look at the structures and the environments that people are operating in that are constraining choices. So that's where you get at a policy agenda. And that's where you get at the idea that these choices aren't inevitable. There's no reason why a mom should have to choose between losing her job and taking care of her sick kid. There's no reason we should have somebody working full time and not being able to get themselves and their family out of poverty. These are choices we've made as a society, and we can make different choices that set people up for better pathways. And I think that it's, you know, it's important to talk about personal responsibility, and it's important to talk about these individual stories, but it's also important to think about what are the structures, what is the environment that people are operating in that are constraining those choices.
Let's go to Warren.
And how did we...
More calls in here, Linda. Thank you. We'll get back to you. Warren in Roanoke, Virginia is on the line. Warren, welcome. Thanks for calling.
I'd like to make a point. I was listening to your program, and one thing y'all missed out on is how much the profit is being made off of poverty, such as the judicial system and the prison system. You know, because if you don't have nothing to do, if you don't have no opportunity, you're going to find some way to eat. You're going to find some way to survive. So, no disrespect, but I feel like that it's a double-edged sword that society swings, you know, because, hey, if you can't make $40,000 a year on a job, you can't find a job, then the prison system can prison you for $40,000 a year.
Warren, thank you. Thank you. Let's get Allison in here from Stowe, Massachusetts. Hi, Allison. Glad you called. You're on.
Hi, Jane. I'm calling because every time I hear these radio shows or about these books, it's so wonderful, and it gives me so much solace that there's other people out there that have been underemployed since this economic crash. I've struggled. I've been paycheck to paycheck, one paycheck, and I'm homeless. I've just been unbelievably hand-to-mouth for years and underemployed with the part-time jobs without benefits, and all of that story is my story. And one of the things I noticed is that you also touched on is the sort of social ramifications of this is where I have friends who are of union positions, and they've actually said to me, well, is it just that you just don't want to work? And I think, wow, when I put a resume out and there's 300 other applicants for me to get that full-time job, how dare you say that to me? And there's a lot of people that are in these sort of positions where they're in a bubble and they just have no idea what's really going on out here.
Allison, thank you. I want to get Henry in here from Lago Vista, Texas. Henry, thank you for calling. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. You're doing a really great job. Linda, thanks for your eloquence and accuracy in describing reality. 55 years in the workforce, 15 years with a good job. That's all I'll say about me. But I want to make the point that Ted Cruz and people like that, the guy that was worried about his sister wanting to depend on welfare, they're looking at things from a viewpoint of conceptual reality, whereas you're looking at what you've experienced with the actual reality of our situation. So thanks a lot. I appreciate you.
Henry, thank you. Thank you very much for calling. We just have a couple minutes left here. Linda, if you could change just one or two things to make the lives of the working poor easier or better, what would they be?
I would make sure that when we are looking at people who have jobs, we are saying thank you and not things that I can't say on NPR. And I would make sure that when we were making policies, that we were actually talking to the people who were going to be affected by them. I went to a congressional hearing, the poverty congressional hearings over the summer, and watched a Democrat not know the difference between cash welfare and SNAP. This is a man on the budget committee who's in charge of those programs. That is a major problem. And third, I would make sure that people understood that as bad as it has been for me, and it was not pleasant, I am young, I am able-bodied, I am capable, I am white, I am intelligent, I have everything going for me, and it was still that bad for me. There are 45 million people out there, not of all of whom have been as lucky as I have been. It is worse for them, and it is an American tragedy. We have got to get this fixed. We can do better. We have done better, and we have to do better.
And Melissa Botayak, what would you change from a policy perspective? You've got this big new report on poverty, the state of poverty in America. What would it be from your perspective?
Well, I think that Linda put her finger on something when she said it's important to make sure that low-income people are consulted on the policies that are moving forward. We would never make business policy without consulting businesses. But I think there's actually some really simple things that we can do. You know, Half in 10, the campaign that is to cut poverty in half in 10 years, had originally shown that if you were to raise a minimum wage, if you were to make the tax credit work, a tax code work better for low-wage working families, if you were to make childcare available and affordable to all those who were eligible for it, That would get us more than halfway to cutting poverty in half in 10 years. This is not rocket science. We can do it, and we need to build the political and public will to enact those kinds of policies.
Linda Tirado, you wrote so eloquently in your book about walking miles to multiple jobs because you didn't have money to fix your car, stacking boxes, cleaning toilets, chronic pain from rotten teeth you couldn't afford to fix. Interestingly, you've said there's one thing you miss about being poor in America. What is that?
A sense of community. If you work in a restaurant and you need a babysitter last minute, you can count on somebody in your neighborhood, somebody in your restaurant, somewhere in your social network. Somebody will come through for you because we cannot make it alone. On the bottom, we live together. We know everything about each other's lives. You know, I can borrow 10 bucks from this guy this week because he gets paid and he can borrow it back from me next week. That is how we survive. Wealthy people are self-sufficient, and so they don't need to develop those networks. And I find that I miss the community. I miss just checking in and seeing, hey, what's up? And everybody tells you every little detail, and nobody worries that it might get, you know, used against you in some corporate takeover somewhere. I don't really understand the social structures, but the community on the bottom is one of the most amazing things you will ever experience in your life.
Well, Linda Tirado, it's such an important work and a really good book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. Thank you so much for your effort and for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Linda Tirado. Also, Melissa Boteach, thanks to you. Melissa is Vice President of the Poverty and Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thanks to you, listeners. This is On Point.